Hang on, let me just officially start the podcast, yes. And we'll jump in.
There you go.
All right, now we're
past the bullshit phase.
Yeah, there we go. Well, I'm going to keep all this in anyway. Hey, everybody, okay. We're officially starting the podcast with my pal and somebody I hung out with in San Francisco, the very, very funny David Koechner. David stars in Superior Donuts on CBS Mondays at 9. Uh-huh. And
stars is pushy it.
Yeah, you appear. And you see him in Another Period on Comedy Central, the Goldbergs. You know him from the Anchorman movies. What's up, buddy? How are you?
I'm good. I'm very well, thank you.
We were just talking how we have a mutual friend in Tom Purcell, and you go back 30 mm-hmm. years from your Second City days, I take it?
Yes, Second City and I.O. days, yes.
Yeah. Well, I just was having dinner with him.
And Brian Stack, who you always you also work with.
Yeah. Brian's...
And is McCann there, too?
No, he's not.
No, okay.
I'm not sure where McCann is now. I don't know if he's still at Conan or where he is, but...
No. I know he went back east.
Yeah.
Maybe he's on Seth. I don't know.
Yeah. So I do the warm-up on the Late Show now, and that's really fun. And then... we hung out in San Francisco when you were doing stand-up, and I caught some of the show. I was working the same weekend. You were at two different clubs, and you were with Dana Gould, and then we hung out and had some dinner together. It was, and you guys were really funny. The acts were really, really great.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. I was excited to talk to you, because I like to watch full-on Koechner on YouTube. And what I'm amazed about is and by the way, at Second City, did you work with Tom Purcell on stage? Did you guys do, were you on the same stages together?
We were in the same class levels.
Oh, okay.
So at Second City at that level, you're writing.
Mm-hmm.
But no, Tom then went on to do some other stuff. I did I.O. Tom was more into the writing.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if he toured or not. He may have. I can't remember.
I think he did. I think he talked. Yeah, because he's talked about touring. What does I.O. stand for? Just for people.
Oh, Improv Olympic.
Okay. And explain just so people, because it's such a storied institution.
For the uninitiated?
Yeah. How the process is.
The complex web of improv.
Yeah.
So, the I.O., it's called I.O. now because Improv Olympic is such an unhip name. it's at its inception, Improv Olympic was, I guess, in some ways, a version of comedy sports,
mm-hmm.
short games, and...
I'm sorry to interrupt you. I'm just hearing, like, background noise and talking.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's okay.
I'm in the kitchen getting coffee.
All right.
There's a bunch of people in here.
No worries. Do you mind?
I'm so sorry.
No. I'm sorry.
Let me grab this cup of coffee as soon as we're done.
All right.
It's President's Day. Can I say what day we're taping?
Yeah, maybe? I know. I'm sorry.
It is President's Day, so there's kids around.
Yeah.
I'm going to go hole up in my room again.
Yeah.
One second.
No worries.
As soon as this coffee is done making its horrible noises.
That's funny.
This is great for the listeners.
Yeah, no, this is like...
you keep all this.
I'm just going to keep it in. That's why I do it. It's like, it's like this is how it works. This is David Koechner at home on President's Day making coffee. He's got a bunch of people in his house. And the poor guy's trying to get 5 minutes apiece from his family. That's what's going on.
Yeah, that doesn't happen.
What's the age range of your kids now?
Well, I'm now sequestered into my room.
All right. Okay. Better?
Yes, sir.
All
okay.
Right.
Where were we? I.O.
Yeah.
It was called the Improv Olympic.
Right.
It was a... Sharna would have groups compete in these games. And her hook at that time, and I'm talking 1985, her hook at that time was to get different professions to take improv classes. Firemen, policemen, nurses, accountants, whomever, right?
Yeah.
So that's what she would tap that source, to fill up classes.
Mm-hmm.
It's much different. Now you've got all these other, people that are interested in show business trying to determine which theater, it gives them the best chance to become famous.
Right, exactly. And the reason she wanted sort of people from sort of every walk of life to do it was it to generate more business for the theater? Was it to kind
yes,
of just,
yeah. It was her, I believe that was her marketing scheme.
Yeah.
You know, you go to these different places, right? Because, you know, otherwise improv was much different than in terms of its popularity,
right,
and its access to audience and access to students.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So she would go, yeah, she had it was a pretty smart marketing move.
Yeah, because stand-up was kind of the thing then. That was sort of the hot thing at that time.
Yeah, 85 was still pretty hot then.
Yeah, yeah, I think so. Yeah, it was kind of starting to kind of wane a little bit because there was a lot of it on TV, But so you do the Improv Olympics and that.
Well, but more importantly than that, I'll try and keep this brief. Del Close started working with Sharna. Mm-hmm. And then the Improv Olympic changed. When I was there, it was still kind of a competition show, but that stopped.
Mm-hmm.
Because then it became a long form show.
Right.
And we'd use these games as basically breaks in the middle of these long form scenes. So really it was just developing the Herald at its nascent stage, if you will.
Right. Right.
And for people that don't do improv, the Herald is a well-known long form show with multiple scenes of varying numbers of people. But the point is to have a scene that you're making up, not trying to find jokes in various situations.
Right. And the subject of the theme of that particular scene is generated how for that night? Like, is that
the theme?
Yeah, well, in other words, scene is going to be like, what's the seed for that particular scene that starts it off?
It, back then you would just take a suggestion, a banal suggestion,
right?
Not something interesting. Now, there are so many different forms. The Herald was the first one, and everything springs from that, all these different forms.
Mm.
But so nowadays people can take any kind of suggestion. You can take a question, you can take an object, you can take a location. But then it was just any word.
Mm-hmm. And then that sort of, and the Herald has spawned variations of itself, is that right? Or sort of in
yes.
some way, shape, or form?
Yes.
Right.
I mean, yeah, now we're discussing jazz now.
Yeah, that's why I do the podcast. I don't really care about anybody else at this point. This is all about where, if I like it, they'll like it. They should hear stuff that they've seen you as Champ Kind. And the reason I'm asking all of this is because of my next question about your character work, which I think is brilliant. And so I want them to understand that there's a foundation. It's not just some guy that rolls out of bed and started doing these characters. And so feel free to geek out. It doesn't matter.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But that, and part of that improv training is developing characters, right? And learning how to write
True.
Characters and then develop those characters. And that's part of what people do. You were on SNL for a year and you have to audition with original characters. And mm-hmm. and they train you to do that. And what is that process like?
Well, I would say, training to do that is probably not necessarily a large part of the curriculum at IO mm-hmm. or at, the Second City,
right.
Where I also studied. I would say that is a larger part of the curriculum at the Groundlings.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a dedicated, I don't know. I've never taken classes there.
Yeah.
What I see is mm-hmm. more of a dedicated model to developing characters, where it's Second City and you're developing scenes because that's scripted. Where at the IO, it's all improv.
Yeah.
So the Improv Olympic is really just pure long form.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in so we're talking about in character is what you find helps you in a scene is a strong point of view, a strong singular point of view that can then lead to development of a richer, deeper character if you choose to, find it later. Now, here's the thing about the IO in the old days. we there was a real distaste for ever repeating a character.
Oh.
So if you had a character that worked, you wouldn't do it the next week because now it felt like you're cheating.
Oh.
It's gotta be, you know, in the now.
Mm.
It's gotta be in the moment. It's almost like you can't plan things.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, if you had a character named Johnny, you're like, I want to pull Johnny out tonight.
Right.
I would be like, nah.
Yeah. Yeah.
But nowadays, I don't know. People might play consistent.
So then how do you develop that character into something that you can sustain and use in later performances? How do you work that out? Or do you? And have you dropped
well,
it? Just drop
personally,
it out there?
What I find out is a point of view that's for a character that I'll do will be something that makes me laugh or has a point of view that's easily accessible to me that might, you know, have certain proclivities that I kind of instantly and readily recognize, and it's just easier to find that voice and point of view. Mm. And so you talk through it, I guess.
How did you get
divination is what I'm talking about.
How did you how did you develop Jerry Prestis? I think because the thing about your characters, Rick, the cat in the balls guy, and by the way, you were so spot on. You made him sound exactly like those guys that do like how to like load a new program onto your Mac iBook. Like it just was like you were so spot on with the impression, but they're so varied. You have Rick, you have Roy Meets World, you have T-Bones, you have Jerry Prestis. And I think that's what's really impressive about your character work is you don't feel like any one of them is... Even in terms of like, you know, like some comedic actors and comedians, they'll have like a certain hook, a certain thing that they do, and they kind of put that into every character. And I don't get that with you. Like, how did you come up with Jerry Prestis, just out of curiosity?
Jerry Prestis, I just think when someone is, the idea was a person that is very passionate, but has no art in his soul.
No nuance
but he's just passionate and he's in sales and that's all he knows and he's not very good at it. He's just determined and his mother was a first chair concert violinist and his father was a sculptor and his sister's a surgeon, but Jerry can't do anything with his hands. They don't do anything. You know, in my mind, there's no art in them.
Yeah.
And he feels like he's got all the passion in the world and no outlet. So he's put it into sales and it's too much. And he's too much for his wife and his kids and basically too much for anybody that he comes into contact with.
Yeah. Well, there's one where you do that. You call it the old bait and switch and you go around the neighborhood looking for, and the reason it was so brilliant because you got to go on YouTube, Google full on Koechner and you'll see a list and click on them all. But this one, I was on the floor. So I'll just do it real quick. So anyway, you're trying to sell something, but you're doing a bait and switch where you're pretending that you're looking for a missing cat. And then you have a conversation with this housewife and that's where all of what you described in him comes out, right?
Yes. Yes. And I will say this. I once, when I was a sophomore in high school, sophomore in college, I worked in Kansas City that summer rather than go back to Tipton to work for my father at the manufacturing plant. I thought I'm going to do something else. So I had all of these sales jobs that never worked. I sold ice cream. I sold cable. I sold encyclopedias. But the encyclopedia thing was interesting in that you had to learn a 10-page script. And the whole thing was about getting the customer to yes.
Yeah.
They called it a takeaway, which is, you know, you're supposed to get in these people's homes and get them to yes. Do you believe that education is important? It's on and on and on.
Yeah.
And if they didn't say yes, you had to say, well, I'm not sure this volume, you know, this set of encyclopedias is right for you.
Yeah.
It was such an old, like an outmoded way of selling.
Yeah.
I thought.
And well, that's what you did with the woman, because then the switch was you were trying to get her to do a gym membership, but you go like, do you work out? Yes. And then I don't know, like I can't remember exactly, but I think you say something like, well, you know, I got a free membership at the gym. Would you be interested? Yeah. And then you switch to wanting her to sign up in six or a month or a year. And then it doesn't, here's the brilliant writing in this for me. So she's like, get out of here. Get out. I got to go. I'm not. She goes, and you say something like, oh, wouldn't your husband appreciate it if you worked out more? Like, oh, yeah. So now you're off the deep end. And then you take the flyer and you throw it in her car and she drives away and you turn. This was such a great topper, such a great cap. You go, see, she has the flyer in the car. Right? That's called a good cold call. And
what, Gary is nothing if not positive.
That's exactly what I wrote down. I wrote he's internally optimistic, which makes the character so compelling to watch because you just see him. And you're right. Like, you really feel like this guy he has no self-awareness at all.
No, not at all.
Now,
and he's got no quit in him.
Yeah, exactly. And then, now when you mentioned his character and you mentioned his father and his mother, what they do and his sister, is part of your character development, right? Is to kind of give us backstory, your characters, because it then helps you execute the character and write for the character. Is that right?
Yeah, to me, for me personally, where the character lies is his pain.
Right.
And so that makes me laugh.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's why.
Right.
You know, to me, it's like we all operate out of pain.
Yeah.
Or, you know, fear of that pain. And so we're either avoiding it or embracing it or trying to figure it out, in my opinion.
Yeah.
And so it's always fun for me to find, you know, some part of their pain body that actually informs what they do every day.
And you do that for every character, pretty much? You give them a little bit of a backstory, if you will, to kind of tap into some of that?
Yeah, depending.
Yeah.
Not all of them
so
much, but like Gerald's the deepest one. I could go on for days about who he is and where he came from and what he did and all that stuff. Because over the years you just develop funny you know, backstory.
Where did Roy Meets World come from? Where did Roy?
Roy.
He's a bit unsettling when you watch him too. Like that one's it's funny, but a little bit like, ugh. You know, you feel like he might have a band.
Roy is a brat. He's a grown up brat who has a victim personality and it's always woe is me. And he's always on the edge of complaint. And he thinks he's fabulous. He was coddled by his mother, and his father did not accept him when he came out. Mm-hmm. In fact, his dad still pretends that day didn't happen. And then Roy eats his pain as well.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he's got eating issues.
So he's a big boy. Now, and to me, it's just funny that as a page boy haircut, and he thinks it's really cool. Now, I will say this. I stopped doing Roy because I just felt like there will be a tight. I just felt like on stage, it was a moment I could feel where people were not cool with me, a straight guy playing a gay guy.
Yeah.
I could feel it.
And then when you layer on the eating issues on top of that, I can understand that. Yeah. Especially now, it's become much more PC now.
The right thing. Although, you know, the point of view of the character just happens to be gay.
Yeah.
I am in no way making fun of anyone being gay.
No.
You know, I'm just living that character. And it's, to me, and I've had plenty of friends, that's the worst thing to say, but he's easily recognizable to, he's a stock Canadian character in the modern world.
Yeah.
He felt like to me,
Ross, the intern, you know, that catty, gay guy that was an intern on the Tonight Show. And now he has his own career and he was on E and he would be real catty about like women's.
Oh, there you go. Sure.
Yeah. And that to me was sort of like, that's, so I agree. Like if I felt like it's a character that I've seen a lot on TV who have that kind of character and they're a little bit of feminine on top of it, you know, but that kind of personality.
Yes. But I felt like it was wrong for me to keep doing.
Yeah. Did you, go ahead. I didn't want you to finish that.
I will just say that I used to, when I first started doing it, I've only been doing stand-up for, 7 years.
Yeah.
Which is a short time. Mm. But when I first started, I don't know if I did Roy that night. You were in
I don't think
San Francisco. I used to bring an extra suitcase and I brought a fat suit for Roy. And in my act, I would change into the fat suit on stage in front of the people And I ended it with this page boy wig, which is a nice wig. It's actually quite expensive. Mm. And then I would just kind of become Roy and then do, you know, 15 minutes of basically one long monologue of Roy telling his lies.
Right, right. What is stand-up giving you, creatively, and how much of an adjustment was it for you moving over from improv, performing and acting to do stand-up? Because they're different disciplines.
Well, the adjustment is, at first I started just with all character pieces. Mm-hmm. So that was a different, because that's kind of what I do rather than, you know, just write jokes or whatever.
Right.
I would say my early show was more like a one man show. Mm-hmm. I think I had 4 or 5 changes in the show.
Hmm. Wow. Yeah. That's pretty involved. And it's evolved.
Did you eat breakfast? Okay.
You know, I was wondering the same thing. I'm glad you asked that. I was worried that.
It's President's Day, so we've got the kids here, and so you got to make sure they're all.
Yeah,
you
know, exactly. Whatever. Exactly. But yeah.
My failing was I didn't lock the door on
No, that's okay.
In the room.
No worries.
If you do, then they start knocking.
Yeah, exactly. Or why?
I'm sorry. We were
saying you were doing 4 changes in one show. It was of a one man show.
It was so stupid. And we're in comedy clubs.
Yeah, exactly.
So people are kind of just.
What is this? You know, what's going on? Yeah.
If they've gone to traditional shows, it's kind of like, what is happening? But I didn't care.
Yeah.
I was like, I got to do what I got to do.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, since then, I no longer change clothes, and it's less character heavy. Now it's very kid heavy in terms of material, just because I have 5 kids. And so that's what I deal with every day. And, you know, I think that you tell me, what do you think at the crux of stand up is something you're complaining about the world in your own unique voice?
I mean, I think that's part of it. You know, we were talking about Tom Purcell, our mutual friend. Tom is a showrunner on The Late Show with Stephen Colbert, and he was on The Colbert Report. And I think that what happens in stand-up, from my perspective, is you start out, and especially if you're not a performer, for you it's different because you walked into it as a performer, so you have stage presence and comfort, but you don't initially. So you're just nervous, and you're writing jokes. You want to relate to as many people. So you're writing what I call surface jokes, like jokes about ketchup or drive-through McDonald's or whatever it might be. And I think if you evolve in the right way, you get to where you're doing, where you're talking about your life honestly, but humorously, and you're willing to kind of expose all of that for who you are and who your family is and whatever. And I think, at the core of it, it is sort of a what's going on, I don't understand, or this is upsetting me kind of point of view. But I think to get to that place is really important to be a good stand-up, like to really sort of be willing to sort of move beyond sort of the banal, you know?
Yes, exactly. And some never do.
Yeah.
But they might still be successful.
Yeah. Because you're reaching a lot of people that way because you're not doing anything that people don't relate to. But what I find for me is I feel like if I have this experience or I feel it, I'm a middle-class kid from Providence, Rhode Island, 95% of the people in the audience are probably relating to it in some way, shape, or form because I'm just an average person.
Because you feel it. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, you know, did you find that when you didn't have a character to be behind, was that a little tricky for you to get adjusted to that, or was that a smooth transition?
You talk about because it also goes back to your second part of the question, was it hard for me to go from improvisation to stand up, and actually it was a great help because, you know, I had all these character pieces, but you'd find stuff on stage and then you develop it. I didn't have to sit and write. I would just stand and talk.
Yeah.
You have an idea, then you explore the idea, then you keep refining it.
Yeah. Yeah. So you make the characters fuller through the stand up. You were able to make the characters fuller.
Certainly can.
Yeah.
Certainly. Or, you know, you just hit subject matters that you find out are universal truths within the audience.
It's so funny. It's the exact same thing with me. I don't know how others work, but I'm at the point now where I'll have a premise and I know there's something there and I try, you know, in front of the computer. But if I back myself into a corner on stage and just start talking about it, generally you find something, you'll find the nugget, and then you put that brick down and then you do it again in another set and you put another brick down. And before you know it, you start to have a fully formed bit. And so,
yeah, and you start, you know, especially if you're yourself, you just start noticing human behavior,
right?
Or what I think are universal relationships in marriage,
yeah,
or universal relationships in institutions, like us versus school, us versus work, us versus religion, all that kind of stuff. You know, if you watch, what's fascinating to me, because we go through so many airports. It's so fascinating how many times you'll see the man in a long-term marriage, because you can see like older people, and he's walking a couple steps behind his wife and his shoulders are slightly bent.
Yeah, exactly.
And he just,
yep.
He just can't.
Yeah, I know. And it says everything. Yeah. And I think as writer performers, we are more attuned to that stuff. I couldn't agree. I got to figure out my way in or where the punchlines are. But about a week ago, I was with three guys. We were at this event and there were a lot of lawyers there. And I was talking to these three white lawyers and I was talking to them. And behind me was this makeshift bar set up. And the bartenders were two African-American guys. So I said, because I was in Washington, D.C. and I hadn't been there in a while and I couldn't remember what subway stop I needed. So I go, can you tell me what subway stop? And the white guys had a look on their face like they had no idea what I was talking about. I barely got the sentence out and the two black guys went, yeah, you want the Vienna stop. And then the guy literally pulled the subway map out on his phone. And I thought that was very telling that the white guys had no idea about the subway and the black guys knew it. And I feel like there's something there to talk about. And that's what I think, like you, your antenna is always up for stuff like that, you know?
Yeah. You know, and the temptation is to be pedantic and say, well, it had nothing to do with them being African-American. Mm. It has everything to do with their access to greater wealth.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the point.
Yeah,
they
exactly.
happen to be African-American because they're part of an oppressed class that uses public transportation.
Right.
And the white guys don't even think about it. Like, they don't even, you know, they hate hearing words like white privilege. And now you've got this entire alt-right white supremacy movement coming back. Well, what are you talking about? Like, well, if you don't give a huge segment of the population access to better incomes, what do you think is going to happen?
Yeah. You know, it's funny because I follow you on Twitter and you're very vocal about politics. No, I think it's great. I am too. I know I retweet Rob Reiner a lot. I think he's just unbelievable. Mm-hmm. And I know that, you know, you've done some work like you made. You were in Thank You for Smoking and you played a gun lobbyist. And I imagine that must have felt good for you because I feel like you're sort of politically attuned and want to have a point of view. Did you enjoy doing that for those reasons?
Oh, well, you know, it was a great script. I mean, you talk about Thank You for Smoking.
Yeah.
It was just a bonus that it was, you know, it had had a point of view like that, such a strong one.
Yeah. Yeah. And when you're doing, I know you're a political poli-sci major at Benedictine College, and then you kind of started to sniff around the whole, you know, improv thing. And then you went home for a year and you worked and you know, your dad had a chicken coop business that he made.
If you don't mind my
correction,
he was a manufacturer of livestock trailers. Livestock trailers and then for turkey coops.
Oh, okay. Got
people,
it, right.
When I say turkey coops, people go, oh, you had a pen in your backyard?
No. I didn't. what was it then that you didn't connect with you for, you know, poli-sci? Obviously, you have something. You still to this day, you have an interest in it, and you speak to it. And like, what was it about improv that was drawing you? Were just a kid growing up,
It was actually, I didn't do the improv until I quit school. I realized in the third year of studies, like, oh, wait a minute. I had this romantic notion that I was going to go out, be a politician and help change the world. Now, I'm from a very small town in Missouri, so I was quite naive in terms of, you know, how things work. If you're in politics, you're either from a political family or you're very wealthy or you're the smartest person in any room you walk into.
Right.
I'm none of those things.
I don't know. I heard you're pretty. I heard you're pretty smart. I heard you're pretty smart. Come on. I heard you're pretty smart.
Yeah. Well, I'm okay, but there's always going to be someone much brighter and more focused.
Yeah.
And then that's another game too. That's where it mirrors show business. Is that to get to the top, you have to be incredibly focused on your goal.
Mm.
And at first, I thought, you know, incredibly focused on helping people, but that really has nothing to do with it.
Right.
Especially now, it's only about money.
Mm. Mm. Yeah.
We get off subject quickly. But so that's
no,
where I
feel
realized,
free.
This,
I want,
this
I,
isn't going to work out. I'm not going to be a lawyer. I don't want to be a lawyer. Mm. I don't want to teach. I think, you know, I realized, oh, I'm seeking a stage.
Mm. Mm. Interesting. That's pretty amazing at that young age you realized that. And improv, you were drawn to improv from seeing SNL on TV and all of that?
Or? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I was 13 when SNL debuted in 1975. And I was fascinated by it.
Yeah. And
I mean, it was live.
Yeah, I know. It's
that
unbelievable.
Hasn't happened. People don't know that there had not been a live television show outside of sports, I don't know, for 20 years. It was a big deal that there was a show.
Maybe it was
going to be on TV that was live, a live comedy show.
Maybe
I remember.
Would it have been Sid Caesar's show of shows, maybe, right? Like going back to the 50s, maybe?
Was that live?
Yeah, I think that was live, but I mean, I don't know. Maybe there's something after that, but that's a really good point. Like a long, long time, there had not been a live comedy show. Yeah.
Yeah. And I just remember there were previews, and it was a big deal.
Hmm.
Like this thing's coming and it's live. It's like, wow, this is going to be a high wire act.
and
you know, just well, luckily, they had, you know, curated an amazing group of people.
Yeah. Yeah.
Of course, no, they, you know, they were already in existence because of, what am I thinking? The Lemmings, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
And its associate,
mm-hmm.
National Lampoon. Mm-hmm. So it was already in place.
Mm-hmm.
It was a matter of collecting the right ones.
How did you get aware of it? Like, were you just reading up on it as you?
I think they what they did do is they ran commercials.
Oh.
They ran some commercials and they did some live commercials. I remember Chevy Chase did Mumbly Peg. And I don't know if people know, Mumbly Peg is when you take a knife and you keep hitting it between your fingers while you're not looking.
Mm-hmm.
Back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth.
Mm.
And it's less dangerous than it appears to be because you can kind of get a rhythm where you're not going to cut yourself.
Right.
But I just thought, well, that's an attention getter. What's this going to be? Yes. And I was a fan of comedy. And I was like, what is happening? I knew my parents would not let me watch it because they were very Catholic.
Mm.
So you're not going to cross a line into anything, you know, remotely controversial.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, so, cause I mean, when I was a kid, I couldn't ever watch, you know, Smothers Brothers, or Laugh-In.
Really?
Even though I was very young, like, we won't be watching that.
Really?
That's too, oh yeah, that was too risque.
Wow. I could see a little bit of that, but I mean, for the most part, there's pretty family-friendly stuff, you know?
Well, that's how Catholic they were.
Yeah.
Their perception of it was, yeah, we're not watching that.
Wow. Interesting.
There was not a real desire for greater ideas.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I can relate to that. I grew up in a middle class home, and my dad put floors in for a living, and my mom worked part time and stuff. And you know, it was definitely like the idea of show business. And I think you've talked about this, like that nobody ever thought of that. And my family, immediate family, friends, that was like going to space. That was like going to the moon. You know,
that's a fool's mission for sure.
Yeah, exactly. It's just insane. And so. This idea of politics. Oh, by the way, I wanted to ask you about Champ Kind and the character you play now in Superior Donuts. How much of an involvement do you have in Champ Kind? For those who don't know, if you don't, you're living under a rock, is the hilarious character that you have play in Anchorman movies. But in the character you play now in Superior Donuts, Tush, how much involvement do you have in the development of that character when it's brought to you, or is it fully formed and you execute it?
Well, Champ, you know, was Adam McKay and Will Ferrell had written the script, and I'd known them for a long time. I had to audition for that part. Hmm. But I think the thing that helped me was like, I understood their tone. So yeah, having, you know, worked with them, I kind of intuitively knew what they were going for.
How would you describe that tone?
Satire.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I don't think people appreciate how satirical Anchorman is. Yeah. They think it's a broad, dumb comedy.
Right.
And I would argue that it's very smart.
Yeah, absolutely. It makes a great point about women in the workplace at that time. And
yeah.
I had Adam on the show. We were talking about his movie, The Big Short, and other things. And he's a very, very smart guy. And it's,
oh, my God. McKay's one of the biggest brains I've ever come across.
Yeah, clearly could do whatever he wants to do, but you know, it's great that he's doing. But that's a good point about Adam, about the character and the movie. Is it is saying something in each of those characters. So was that, so that character as played was sort of the way it was presented to you, or did you sort of tweak it and add to it as it went along?
It was on the page.
Yeah.
And again, for me, it was all about the pain. Champ Kind is in trouble.
Mm.
He is in deep pain.
Mm.
He's clearly an alcoholic.
Right.
He is a misogynist.
Yeah.
He is a jingoist. He's a xenophobe. He's closeted.
Mm.
So he's got all of this complexity, and he's very angry.
And very lonely. And very lonely,
oh, yeah,
too.
And so to me, that's hilarious.
That scene, I'm sorry to do this to you, but that scene where you're sitting in front of the news desk and you're like, right, I miss you. I miss your laugh. I miss your scent. And it's like, okay, that's enough. Like that all came through in that moment, you know, for me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And to me, it's the fun part is playing that. And we all know someone like that.
Yeah.
Or we all have had feelings like that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there are plenty of people we all had like, huh, that's funny. I thought me and that person might be friends.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then
yeah,
you stew about it in your head, like, oh, why? Well, why don't we hang out?
Yeah. We went bowling and I paid for everything last week, and yeah, he doesn't appreciate me.
Bob, and Bob and I are very close. How come you and I...
See, this is what I want people to understand, like how much goes into, it's not just some guy, you put a big dumb hat on you and you put on a Western accent and you just start acting like an idiot. Like, so all of that description for him, for you, was sort of layered on top of what Adam and Will had given you in the script. Like, this is the character, but then you went deeper and sort of added those components about his backstory to get more out of the guy. Is that fair to say?
Well, yeah, that's just what I saw in it.
Yeah.
And like, to me, that's what made me laugh is his, you know, he's doing all of these things to mask his pain. He's in absolute denial.
Right.
Which to me is hilarious.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's like, just
too play those notes.
Yeah, exactly. And obviously in the movie, you shoot the script, but then they let you play and go off script and sort of, and
that's unique because McKay is, one of the few people that can handle actors improvising, and he tends to hire people who have an improv background.
Mm-hmm.
But the amazing thing is that, you know, his process is so magnanimous because there's no ego to it. He's like, oh, you might have a better line.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Like, I can't write better than McKay. Are you crazy?
But to go back to what you were saying on stage about taking your characters and doing them in a stand-up show and then on stage, they flourish and you get more. I do think in the moment, as that character, you probably can write as good as Adam McKay. Maybe not in front of a computer sitting down in a more theoretical sense, but I do think as a performer who's so good at what you do and then has this background that you've created for this character, I do think that you could come up with lines as the character that maybe Adam couldn't.
Okay. You know, I would say empathically and emotionally, I might have a point of contact that is, might have a different component.
Right. So you also did this movie, Priceless. You got the producer, Steve Barnett, sent you the script, and it's about human trafficking. And you seemed, from what I read, excited to do it. It's pretty intense movie. What was it about that really drew you and to do it and to take it and try it?
Well, a couple of things. Number one, it's work.
You got five kids.
Yeah. I get to hang out with my buddy Steve for 2 weeks in Albuquerque.
That's not bad.
It was a drama, so that was something different. So
yeah.
I have to get a little bit different look, right?
Mm. Yeah, absolutely.
I have to do something I don't normally do.
Mm-hmm.
And then of course, the subject matter was important. I've got three daughters, and people don't realize what a epidemic human trafficking is.
Yeah, I didn't know. I kind of started, when I was reading about this, I started to look, kind of read more about it, and it opened my eyes.
It's horrifying.
There
are, active kidnaps of young girls, and then they're sold around the world. And that's not, and that it is in the United States.
Hmm.
It happens.
Yeah. Yeah, to me, the surprise was the
15-year-old girl and her friend walking in a parking lot. A van pulls up. They grab her. It's it. It's over.
Yeah, yeah. And that's the part that surprised me, the kidnapping part. I guess in the back of my mind, I assumed it was runaways, that had problems with their families.
Well, we all do.
Yeah.
Everyone thinks it's runaways or broken homes or whatever. No, no, no.
Yeah.
It can be anyone.
Yeah.
That's not the typical way, because
right.
if girls were getting kidnapped, regularly, then there would be, bigger announcement on the news.
Yeah.
A lot of times they do come from, single parent families or whatever,
right.
Or they start dating a guy,
right.
And the guy suggests to her that, why don't you do this for extra money?
Mm.
And then turns out this guy might be a pimp.
Right.
And then he sells her.
Yeah. Yeah. It definitely opened my eyes. Where before we wrap up here, politically, with where we are right now, how do you feel about it all? I mean, I know it's a big question, but sort of where do you think do you think the pendulum swings back after this?
They can't help it. I think number one, this is the longest train wreck in U.S. history. It is now beyond the pale in terms of what's civil or human. It's just, I can't conceive where the support comes from. It just shows you how much money must be at the top. Because why else would they be protecting him? He's absolutely unqualified. He is a dangerous monstrosity that they are allowing to happen, which means to me they must all be caught up in some dangerous money scheme. Put their fingers. Go ahead.
Yeah. No, I was just saying, but it's, I don't think it's just the money side of things. There's a disenfranchised group of people in those states that voted for him. The lower middle class and lower class that, it opened the eyes to how much everybody missed how disenfranchised a lot of Americans were, that they would vote for this guy. That his election to me told me how sick our country was. That in terms of, and no one caught it, no one figured it out, and now we're aware. And I got to tell you, though, what scares me is everything he does plays to that crazy base, and then the money people like him because he's going to cut their taxes. He could get in again. I mean, even with all this nonsense.
Oh, no. He's going to be indicted within 6 months.
Oh, I hope so.
He is dirty. They're going to find international money laundering.
Yeah.
That's where this is going to wind up.
Yeah.
Someone said the other day, there's some RICO component to what they came out with recently, which is racketeering.
Right.
So yeah, he's got dirty money.
Yeah.
He's been a bad business guy. He couldn't get an American bank to loan him money.
Right.
And yet he had access to international funds where he just put up a building
in
New York.
Mm.
I mean, someone out there knows exactly what it is. But plus, I mean, just as a character thing, how is she? Look, the lawyer came out and said, I made the payment to her for $130,000.
I know. I know.
And then we're already past it.
I know.
Like, wait. What?
Yeah. But that's what
the wife stays.
But that's what I mean about the pendulum. Does it come back? Because we've become so jaded and hardened to, yeah, well, he said I grabbed their pussies. Okay, well, there's that. Now we had a porn star and someone paid. Well, there's that. Well, he's still whatever. You know, like, I mean, I don't know what it is that this guy has to do. I mean, he's the one, and it was prescient, who said, I could shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue and get away with it. And maybe he can. Like, so I don't know if the pendulum swings back. I'm not sure.
I think it absolutely will, because at what price?
Yeah.
The way I look at it, it came down to two things: abortion and brown people.
Yep.
I had relatives that voted for him only because, now I think if there was not an open vacancy on the Supreme Court, I don't think he would have gotten in.
Yeah, that's a good point.
It was all about, we have to have a Republican who will put in a pro-life jurist on the Supreme Court.
I'm talking about this in my act. I say these very devout anti-abortionists, they will sell their morals for their political values, because the evangelical ministers were continuing to back Roy Moore, who was clearly a pedophile.
And oh my God.
So he could get into the Senate and make sure abortion was abolished. So they care more about the unborn child than they do about the poor child that this guy's stalking at the malls. And
exactly.
and no one really was making that point. Or if they were, I didn't hear it very much. And that's the part that scared me, that I go on some of these shows, like I'll go on CNN, MSNBC, Fox News, and I, you know, go on and try to use satire to kind of keep everybody honest. But everybody's just like, I got my beliefs. I got to win every one of my points. If I don't win every one of my points, if I give up one point, then I lose the whole thing. No one wants to acquiesce on anything. It's a really bad tone and tenor right now.
Yeah. Well, that and this race baiting.
Yeah.
It's
disgusting.
The dumb idea that someone from a lower economic background, from someone disadvantaged, is an impediment to you,
right,
is just crazy.
Yeah.
Now,
yeah.
I don't know where all that came from. That was already there.
Yeah.
Now, it's always been part of our country, but I didn't know it was that bad, which speaks to the bad economic situation so many people are in.
Right. And they need...
It's only going to get worse.
Yeah. And so people need to blame somebody.
How can the same people say they don't want access to health insurance?
Yeah, I don't. I know.
You know, it's not about Obama, right, which, you know, the grand wizard made it about Obama.
Yeah.
With the birther movement.
Yeah.
It's, and so they want to repeal Obamacare. Like, well, how many of you guys can explain to me what that means?
Right. It just becomes a mantra, and then people sort of follow lockstep, and they he keeps saying, there's no collusion. And if he says it enough, it's like click your heels three times and it comes true. It is. Superior Donuts, Mondays at 9. You're enjoying that character.
On the coasts.
Yeah.
Pardon?
You're enjoying the character, and that's another character where you sort of, I really like the fact, he also seems like an eternal optimist in a lot of ways, that character.
Yes. I've decided that he's a survivor.
Yeah, there you go. Okay.
That's his modus operandi. And, you know, in sitcom, sometimes your character is absolutely defined, and sometimes it's in flux. Mm. And that's what's fun. Mm. I am holding on for dear life, and my character does change week to week in terms of what his knowledge base seems to be.
That's a nice way of putting it. Give people a little quick background if they haven't seen the character, seen the show yet, but what it is that this character is, and, you know, kind of where he finds himself at this point in his life.
I don't know, they even said this, but my guess is he's from downstate Illinois. Now, we're in Chicago. He's moved up to Chicago years ago, but he probably grew up in downstate Illinois. And then he worked at a tractor factory for 25 years, and then it closed. And he had no real skills or abilities to, you know, switch gears and get a new job. So now he's part of the gig economy, and he takes basically anything he can get. He's divorced, no kids so far, but as you know, in sitcom, they can always change.
Right, exactly.
And so, yeah, he's also a lonely guy. And that's why he, you know, goes to the donut shop, because that's where his friends are.
It's called
people that will tolerate him.
Right. It's called Tush Tushinsky. That's, it's so great the way you create the backstory for these guys, and then really sort of, you can see that all come through. Well, check out Superior Donuts, everybody. That's CBS Mondays at 9. What else you got that you want people to see these days? I know you're in another period. You're in the Goldbergs. Anything else going on?
Gosh, I don't know. You know, you do a movie and you never know what's going to come out. Let's see. What's happening? Gosh, I don't know.
All right. Well, the next thing that's coming out, you come on again, because we have a lot more stuff we should talk about.
I'll just show up on your TV or your movie screen.
Yeah. Okay. We'll get you on again and we'll plug it and we'll talk. We could talk all day. There's so much other stuff I want to get to, but I don't want to keep you from the family. So listen, it's David Koechner, brilliant, brilliant actor, comedic actor, stand up. See him on tour and see him in Superior Donuts, CBS Mondays at 9. Thanks, man. It was great catching up with you again. It's been a while since we talked when we were in San Francisco, but thanks for being on. I really appreciate it.
Right on. Thank you so much.